Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kelly, your host, and as promised, Jimmy Akin here with us for an hour of open forum. You're welcome to call with any question you've got, 888-318-7884. Anybody's welcome, Catholic, not Catholic, Christian, not Christian, you're welcome to call, 888-318-7884. Jimmy is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the author of The Bible is a Catholic Book and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Happy Wednesday, Jimmy.
Happy Wednesday, Cy Kellett, host of Catholic Answers Live.
I'm so glad to get to see you on a Wednesday.
Yeah.
This is a nice little bonus.
A little different.
Yeah.
So shaking things up. Keep them guessing.
Yeah, that's right. We don't a Rolling Stone something moss. Gathers no moss.
That's what they say.
Yeah. So we're not gathering moss around here. 888-318-7884.
Are we gathering wool?
What does that mean, wool gathering?
Wool gather?
Wait, wool gathering. What does that mean, actually? I don't know what that metaphor
is.
Well,
in the literal sense, it's, you know, when you shear your sheep and you get their wool.
Yeah.
Take their wool. But in the metaphorical sense, it's just kind of daydreaming and not kind of chilling, not really thinking about anything serious.
Oh, I've spent most of my life wool gathering.
Mm-hmm. So you could be a wool gatherer and a lotus eater.
Yeah. Well, a lotus eater, I don't know so much.
It's a little different, but lotus eaters do a lot of wool gathering.
Lotus eaters do a lot of wool gathering, but not all wool gatherers are lotus eaters.
True.
It doesn't work that way. The Venn diagram.
Yeah.
888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. You're welcome to call with your questions.
About what? What can people ask about?
Earth, any of the planets, the stars, the sun, or anything else in the universe, or anything that's not in the universe, God, the sacraments, Jesus, the Pope, the Bible.
Okay.
Anything else?
Oh, sure. Yeah, lots of stuff.
Black holes.
Yeah. Or things that may not be black holes, like Sagittarius A star.
Okay, I don't know what Sagittarius A star is.
Well, it's a body that is about 4 million times the mass of our sun. It's located at the center of the Milky Way galaxy. From Earth's perspective, the galactic hub, the core of the galaxy, is in the direction of Sagittarius.
Oh, so you're looking
through Sagittarius to the center of the galaxy, 26,000 light years away. At the very center of the galaxy, there's this massive dark body called Sagittarius A star, and the star is like an asterisk.
It's like an A
with an asterisk after it.
Okay.
But it's vocalized A star, and it has been proposed for a long time that it's a black hole, that it's a supermassive black hole, and we see such supermassive black holes at the hearts of many galaxies, and so it wasn't really a surprise when we found one here. And we can actually image it so well, we can see bodies circling around it, you know, orbiting around it, stars at the core of the galaxy. And back in 2014, scientists were really excited because they saw a gas cloud this is how good our astronomy is now. We can see a gas cloud 26,000 light years away about to enter this dark body. And they expected it, as it's approaching the event horizon of what they think is the event horizon of Sagittarius A star, they think it's going to get sucked in, and then there will be this brilliant, like, flare of X-rays as it crosses the event horizon.
Yeah.
Which is what would happen with a black hole. And instead, none of that happened.
What?
It got stretched out, but it slingshotted around Sagittarius A star. And so there is a new theory that maybe this is not a black hole at all. Maybe it is just a supermassive clump of dark matter, which would not behave the way a black hole does.
Oh.
And it even could help explain some of the supermassive black holes we see in other galaxies because we can tell some of them are black holes, but there's a problem with how would you get, given how long the universe has been around, how would you get something weighing not millions but billions of times the mass of the sun in a black hole, because the way we expect black holes to form is when a star
collapses,
maybe a star 3 or even 100 times that of our sun. It's still nowhere near billions. So how could it get that much mass into it in this fairly short space of time?
Yeah.
Well, maybe what they've proposed is that they've run the math on this, if you get a clump of dark matter that's big enough, it can turn into a black hole. And so maybe...
But it would be a different kind of black hole?
Well, it'd be a supermassive black hole.
Okay.
But maybe that's why we see some supermassive black holes at the cores of other galaxies. Maybe they weren't formed from stars. Maybe they were formed from clumps of dark matter.
What do you know?
Yeah.
A possible dark matter at the... Sometimes you say these things and I don't find them comforting. I mean, I don't like being even within 26,000 light years of a giant clump of dark matter. It makes me uncomfortable.
Dude, you don't have to worry.
I don't have to worry. I just do.
Well, so dark matter would be less threatening than a black hole.
Oh, all right.
So that's good. Okay. Also, dark matter, if dark matter exists, it's all over the place anyway. It's here in this room right now.
What?
Yeah.
No one has told me about this before.
Yeah. The reason it's called dark is not because it's black. It's because it only interacts with other matter by gravity. It does not interact with light and similar energy. So light just pew right through it.
What?
It also, because it's not affected by electricity, it doesn't interact with atoms. So there can be dark matter just sheeting through your body right now. And because there's so little mass, it doesn't. You don't notice it. It's only on cosmic scales that you would get the effect of its gravity.
So stuff could pass through dark matter, and dark matter could pass through stuff.
Yes.
So this makes me think. This is something I've always wanted explained. Mm-hmm. Maybe when Wile E. Coyote painted that black thing on the side
hole,
of a mountain,
the tunnel, yeah,
dark matter passed right through it.
Well,
what do you think? I'm a scientist. I think I'm a scientist.
You can propose that, and you should write a paper and see if you can get it published in a peer-reviewed journal.
Beep, beep. Let's go to Aiden in, Berlinger? I'm going to say
Berlinger.
Berlinger, Kentucky, listening on the new and improved Catholic Answers Live app. Thanks for waiting, Aiden. Go ahead with your question.
Okay. I'm just wondering how we respond to the Protestant objection to Jesus in the Eucharist when they use John chapter 6, verse 63.
Okay. So now, first of all, we should point out that many, many Protestants believe in the real presence. They may not articulate it the way we do or, you know, conceive of it quite the way that Catholics do, but many, many Protestants do believe in it. Lutherans, lots of Anglicans, lots of Methodists, other people. In terms of this specific verse, so it's John 6:63. It's part of the Bread of Life discourse in John 6, where Jesus does talk about the Eucharist. And in verse 63, he says, "The Spirit gives life, the flesh counts for nothing. The words I have spoken to you, they are spirit and life." Or in some translations, it'll say they are full of spirit and life. Well, the part of this that those Protestants who don't believe in the real presence rely on is the part where Jesus says the flesh counts for nothing. And they will read that as if it's some kind of dismissal of the idea that that the Eucharist really contains his body. But that's clearly not what it means, because whose flesh are we talking about here? Cy Kellett, host of Catholic Answers Live, whose flesh is under discussion in this chapter?
Jesus.
So would it be true that Jesus' flesh counts for nothing?
Absolutely not.
Right. It absolutely would not. It was Jesus' flesh and his sacrifice on the cross that redeemed the world. So if there's anybody whose flesh does not count for nothing, it's Jesus Christ. His flesh is effectual. And that's a big clue that is not what he's saying here. He's not saying his flesh counts for nothing. So what other flesh might he be talking about? Well, one of the metaphors that's commonly used in Scripture for flesh is human nature, you know?
Yeah, right. Right.
Paul will talk about what the flesh wants to do, and he means what human nature wants to do. He'll talk about the fleshly man as opposed to the spiritual man, referring to someone who's just living with their fallen human nature as opposed to having been elevated by the Spirit. And guess where we also find that metaphor, Cy Kellett, host of Catholic Answers Live?
The metaphor for the flesh.
For the flesh being human nature. What other biblical book that might be relevant to the present discussion?
I'm so sorry that I'm drawing.
Where we're talking about the Gospel of John.
I feel so embarrassed. Oh, I don't know. You're going to have to help me. I've totally blanked.
The Gospel of John.
Oh, okay. Right.
It's elsewhere in the Gospel of John. This is John chapter 6. Yeah. You look a couple of chapters.
I was still thinking about Wile E. Coyote. I'm sorry.
No problem.
I got a real bad.
To get us back on track,
yeah.
You look a couple of chapters later, Jesus is talking with his opponents, and he says, you judge according to the flesh. Meaning they're just judging him and his ministry according to a fallen, natural human perspective. Whereas that's contrasted or to be contrasted with the spiritually enlightened or spiritual perspective, just like St. Paul does. And so given that biblical background and the fact we find these metaphors in both St. Paul and in St. John, the natural way, it seems to me, to understand what Jesus is saying in John 6:63 is the Spirit, meaning the Holy Spirit, gives life because he enables us to judge things from a spiritual perspective and accept Jesus' teachings, whereas the flesh counts for nothing because a fallen human fleshly perspective without the Spirit's enlightenment will not enable you to come to Jesus and accept his message and believe it when he says things like this. So that's how I would take it. I think it's well supported by the context in both St. John's Gospel and in the New Testament in general. And I also think it's very clear from what from the fact that it is Jesus' flesh that redeems the world that clearly he is not saying his flesh counts for nothing.
Aidan, I hope that was helpful to you. Thank you very much for getting us started with our open forum this afternoon. Right now we got a free ebook for you. You just head over to shop.catholic.com and it's The Beginner's Guide to Biblical Prophecy. If you want to know about biblical prophecy, get that free ebook right now at shop.catholic.com.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
The people who call More to Life are often hurting so much. I just want to reach through the radio and hug them. I want them to know how loved they are and how much God wants to fill their hearts with his healing grace and his deep desire to completely transform the life of anyone who's open to the movement of his Holy Spirit.
More to Life with Dr. Greg and Lisa Popcheck tomorrow morning, 10 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin here with us this hour, a little bonus open forum for you this week. If you've got any question at all about the Catholic faith, sacraments, the Pope, the Bible, got a moral question, a philosophical question, or any other question at all, they are welcome here. 888-318-7884. Next we go to Fairfax, Virginia. Joe in Fairfax, listening on the new and improved Catholic Answers Live app. Go ahead, Joe, with your question for Jimmy.
So I was wondering if Jimmy could respond to the claim that it's a bit of a personal thing that I feel, but I think there's just a lot of people share it, that there seems to be a lack of financial transparency in the church.
You know what, Joe, you're breaking up, and so I'll tell you what. I think you got enough out though for Jimmy to give an answer to. So Joe's saying there's a lack of financial transparency in the church. So what can we do about that if that's the case? Well, first of all, I suppose, is it the case, and what can we do about it?
It's going to depend on what you mean by financial transparency. Anything other than here's an itemized list of every single asset and expenditure and item of income can be accused of lacking some transparency. Even if, when you file your taxes, every year, you don't give the IRS a list of all of your assets and all of your income itemized.
No.
Every payment you got, every coin you got, and every expense, everything you purchased, you don't give them an itemized list of all of that stuff. So from if you have the kind of maximal definition of financial transparency, then Sykelet, you're not being financially transparent when you file your taxes.
Right, but that's just not true. But, I mean, that's
not what we mean.
Right.
So we have some other standard of financial transparency that allows for things like summaries, of assets and income and expenditures. And there are various, in the accounting world, there are various ways to assess that. There are different levels of scrutiny that auditors can apply to things. And if you want to say there's a lack of financial transparency in the church, well, the church has over a billion members. So I'm sure somewhere there is a lack of financial transparency, but it's kind of painting the church with a broad brush to say the whole thing. I mean, what are you talking about? If you mean the Vatican, well, I would say you've got a case there. Because they're at various institutions, financial institutions in the Vatican, like the Institute for the Works of Religion, commonly known as the Vatican Bank, there has historically been a difference between the levels of financial reporting that this institution has used right. in its own financials versus what's commonly used in European accounting and banking systems like MoneyVal, right. for example. And so that's true. On the other hand, what about your local parish? Well, I don't know. I don't know. Maybe your parish has properly conducted audits every year.
Right.
Or maybe your local diocese does. The church is not a single financial institution. It has many financial institutions, and so I think it would be unfair to just say, oh well, the church is not financially transparent. I think it's going to depend on where you're talking about. But as I said, in the case of just like with different corporations, you know, you could make a broad brush charge and say American Business isn't financially transparent.
Oh, well.
Well, I'm sure some American businesses aren't, but that right. doesn't mean they all aren't. And in the same way, some local churches may not be financially transparent, but others may be. So if I think you have to be more specific. Now, if you are specific and if you – then you can I'd have to know where you're talking about to make recommendations about how to deal with it. In the case of the Vatican, there has been a multi-year project to bring the Vatican Bank right. and other related institutions into compliance with standard European accounting practices. And so I would say that to the extent that they're not there yet, that may be the case. In fact, that is the case. But they are making progress, and there has been a multi-year effort to reshape the reporting of those institutions, and I would expect that within a few years they're going to achieve the same levels of accounting certification that other European banks do.
Joe, I hope that was helpful to you. I thank you very, very much for the question. Lots of folks on the line, and I'm going to keep moving. Now going to Arlington, Texas, also listening on the new and improved Catholic Answers Live app is Casey in Arlington, Texas. Casey, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hello. So thanks for taking my call. My question is, I have a family member who also, she's not Catholic, but she's more like United Church of Christ, Episcopalian kind of proud.
Okay.
And she said that a lot of Bible scholars no longer believe that Paul is the author of Ephesians, citing that the dating of Ephesians is about 10 to 15 years past the lifetime of Paul. And I was just wondering if there's any legitimacy to those claims.
Well, it's true that a lot of modern scholars don't think that Ephesians was written by Paul. It's one of a number of his letters that are classed by some scholars as deuteropauline, meaning they weren't written by Paul himself, but they were written by people within his circle. Now, that in itself is not something that strikes at the faith. What the faith teaches is that Ephesians is a divinely inspired book. And so as long as you say, as long as you're willing to say, this is God's word, this is divinely inspired, it can be something of a historical question of whether Paul himself wrote it or whether Paul's followers wrote it on his behalf to illustrate what he would have to say about the particular subjects that it addresses. Having said that, I think Paul wrote it, and I don't think the arguments against it are good. In particular, the argument that the argument, Casey, that you just mentioned some people is using, I think is a particularly lame one. The idea was, Casey said, that some people were saying, well, it's dated a decade or so too late. Yeah. How do you know?
Yeah.
It doesn't have a date on it. Really, what happens is if it's written by Paul, then that tells us it has an earlier date. If it's not written by Paul, but his followers, then that tells us it has a later date. But we don't know the date.
Yeah.
So it really, the authorship question is primary here. Now, what will happen in some of these discussions is people will say, well, it reflects the theology of this later decade. So it must have been written 10 years later than other works. Okay, how do you know that?
I know.
How do you know? I mean, in any given, we're talking decades. That's just a period of 10 years.
Right.
My career as an apologist is almost three of those now.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you could take something that was an apologetic work and say, was this written in the 2000s or the 2010s or the 2020s or the 1990s? How can you tell, unless it's got references to specific historical events, how are you going to tell just by the flavor of the apologetics
right.
and the literary style? There's no way to do that because you're going to have different people with different styles, and you're going to have some people who are ahead of the curve. You're going to have some people who are thinking ahead of, in apologetics, of where other apologists are.
Yeah.
And, I try to do that. Instead of just repeating the standard apologetic arguments that you'll hear from anybody, I'm trying to think into the future and bring in new relevant information and thus be ahead of the curve. Well, St. Paul was kind of like that too. He was an advanced theologian. And so even if it took a few decades, a decade or more, for other people to catch on to ideas he was already talking about,
right.
that would just mean he was an advanced thinker. And we already knew that. He's a smart guy. That's why he wrote so many books, and his books were so highly valued. Duh, Paul is a smart guy. So this entirely subjective kind of, ooh, this feels like it's maybe 10 years later, even though there are no references to historical events. That's just a super lame argument. There's a lot more that could be said about this. The basic principles for dating in absence of specific historical references, like, oh, remember when the World Trade Center fell?
Yeah, that would give you a good
that
date.
Would
that
give
had
you,
to happen
yeah.
after a certain date. Yeah.
yeah. In the absence of things like that, and Ephesians does not have a lot of chronological dating cues like that, what you do to date it is you say, and to also figure out who wrote it, is you say, well, what does the external testimony say? And the external testimony concerning Ephesians is that it's Paul. Everybody says Paul wrote it in the early church. Nobody says anybody but Paul wrote it. So we have very strong external attestation that Paul was the author. You then look at the book internally and say, well, is there anything that makes that impossible? And when you look at the arguments that are proposed, like the dating argument we just considered, none of them do that. So I would say that, yeah, Ephesians is just written by Paul, and the counterarguments do not succeed. And then in terms of figuring out when it fits into Paul's timeline, you look at other related letters. It is to be noted that Colossians is extremely similar to Ephesians, suggesting they were written at the same time. And Colossians is one of the prison epistles that was written when St. Paul was imprisoned in Rome around AD 60, thus late in his career, which could
sure.
also explain why it sounds later than
yeah.
some other things, because it is late in his career. So if you'd like to follow up on that, there are some books on the historical reliability of the New Testament by Craig Blomberg, B-L-O-M-B-E-R-G, or maybe it's U-R-G. And he has a book in which he covers the different arguments connected with this. If you want to get something for free online that also looks at these kind of issues, go to Bible.org, and they have a series of articles on the different books of the New Testament by Daniel Wallace, Daniel B. Wallace, who's a Protestant scholar. And he has a very nice treatment of each book of the New Testament and who wrote it and things like that. So check out Daniel B. Wallace's treatment of Ephesians at Bible.org.
Okay, Casey.
That sounds great. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. What perfect timing. We got to take a quick break. Lots of folks on the line, so we've got lots more questions for Jimmy. It's open forum, so you never know what those questions will be. We'll be right back with more of that open forum right here on Catholic Answers Live, right after this.
Catholic Answers Live.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Catholic Answers is doing it again. We're holding our 7th annual Apologetics Conference this September in beautiful San Diego, California, and we'd like to see you there. Join us September 23rd to 26th for a lively and inspiring conference with an all-star lineup of speakers guaranteed to jumpstart your faith. It's a great chance to meet all your favorite Catholic Answers apologists and very special guests as we spend 4 days talking about worshiping and adoring our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. This is where it all begins. Don't miss what promises to be the event of the season. Join us this September for a conference that is sure to ignite, inspire, and inform your faith. Seats are still available, but they're going fast. Enter promo code EARLY to save $30. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 888-291-8000 to register.
Anna Mitchell here. Join us tomorrow morning for the Sunrise Morning Show when we celebrate 6 months until Christmas Eve with the Nativity of St. John the Baptist, plus Dr. John Bergsma on the birth of the Levitical priesthood in Exodus. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. It's open forum this hour with Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, where the conversation about real life zombies will continue on Friday. Is that correct?
That's right. We're going to be covering the case of a man named Clervius Narcisse, who was medically verified dead in the early 1960s and then was discovered to be alive and walking around in years later. And he got to go sit on his own tomb. In fact,
weird.
In fact, for the episode artwork, we have a picture of Clervius Narcisse sitting on his own tomb where he had been buried in the 60s.
So you can catch new episodes each Friday of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Up next, we go to Amarillo, Texas, listening on 94.5 FM. David in Amarillo, you are up. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Jimmy, big fan. Thanks for taking my call. My question was regarding the Jewish temple and its rebuilding after 70 AD and the destruction. I am Catholic, been Catholic for about 20 years, but I grew up in a pretty strong dispensationalist background, and that's obviously a big part of that theology. And I'm just curious, I mean, I've heard the story of like Julian the Apostate back in the 360s trying to rebuild it, and that didn't seem to work very well, and just curious though, like within Catholic eschatology, is that something that is going to be necessary in the way that we interpret the end times, or is that kind of more of just dispensationalist stuff?
Well, and this isn't just true of Catholic theology. It's true, what I'm about to say is more true broadly of Christian theology or Christian eschatology in general outside of dispensationalism. Now, I should mention eschatology is a branch of theology. It deals with the last things. In Greek, eschatos means last, and so eschatology means the study of the last things, like what's going to happen at the end of the world. And also death, judgment, hell, and heaven, with purgatory thrown in as a bonus. Now, in the New Testament, there are various passages that seem to be dealing with the end of the world and that speak of the temple of God as being in existence at that time and playing a role in some of these prophecies. And then the temple, there are not passages that say the temple is going to be rebuilt. The reason people talk about the temple being rebuilt is because there are these passages that seem like they are maybe about the end of the world and that seem like they indicate God's temple is going to be standing at that time. And then the temple goes and gets destroyed in AD 70.
Yeah.
So what are we to make of these passages? Well, one possibility is that they may not all be dealing with the end of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them may be dealing with events that occurred in the first century. And so the temple was standing at that time and played a role in those prophecies. I think that's the case, for example, in Mark chapter 13. I think Mark chapter 13 is all about, at least in its primary fulfillment, it's all about the first century.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one way of taking the passages. A second way of taking the passages is to say, okay, these passages do pertain to the end of the world. And since the temple was destroyed in AD 70, that means the temple needs to be rebuilt before the end of the world so that it can play its role in these prophecies. And that view is common in a branch of Protestant theology known as dispensationalism. Then there's another way, and this historically I think has probably been the most common way, both among Catholics and Protestant Christians, is to say, well, these passages do, at least in part, pertain to the end of the world, but it's not a literal earthly temple
mm-hmm.
they're talking about. Maybe the temple of God isn't the temple in Jerusalem. Maybe it's the church, which is the temple of God in another sense. And so those are all three options. The church does not have a teaching about which one of them is correct. I think the last one is probably the most common, but I myself am open to all three. I'm particularly inclined towards the first two, that either a given passage is not really about the end of the world, or or there may be a rebuilt temple if the passage is about the end of the world. Because to a first century Jew, saying the temple of God is just going to call to mind the temple in Jerusalem.
Oh, yeah. Right.
They're not going to think the church.
Yeah.
Having said that, prophecy can be fulfilled in a way the prophet himself did not anticipate. Yeah. And so I can't rule out the third option.
What do you think, David?
No, excellent. Thank you. When people talk about the potential of, I know Dome of the Rock is there now, but mm-hmm. a rebuilt temple, would that be then kind of would that raise your ear that, hey, maybe we're getting near the end? I mean, as dispensationalists would?
I think that the if people started actually rebuilding a temple in Jerusalem, that would be a significant marker that we might be near the end. But then I'd say the reconstitution of Israel after 1900 years was also something that could be a sign that we're closer to the end than not. On the other hand, maybe that's not the case. I can't say.
David, thanks very, very much. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. We're going to go now to Rochester, New York, listening on Catholic.com. David in Rochester, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Jimmy, I got a mysterious world type question for you.
Okay.
What is your take on remote viewing? Are people who are taking courses of this stuff, are they throwing away their money, or is there something to this?
Okay. So we should explain what remote viewing is. This is a report. This is a technique that was developed starting in the 1970s as part of a research program involving actually the CIA and the Defense Department, and a particular form of remote viewing called controlled remote viewing was developed to allow people who were not naturally gifted psychics to be able to learn how to do this and get better than chance results.
Mm-hmm.
And this was used, for example, in the Defense Department Stargate program, which used remote viewing to try to obtain intelligence information against the Soviets and the Chinese and terrorists and drug smugglers and criminals and so forth. And the program lasted for about 20 years. It was eventually closed, and when it was closed, and the CIA was the owner of the program at that time, though they weren't initially. But when it was closed, they commissioned a study to be done of how well did it work? Was there actual evidence that this gave better than chance results? And there were two individuals that were commissioned to head the study. One of them was the sometime president of the American Statistical Association, a professor of statistics named Jessica Utz. The other was a psychologist and skeptic named Ray Hyman.
Mm-hmm.
So they wanted to make sure this wasn't slanted one way or the other.
Right.
And in reviewing the evidence, Jessica Utz, the professor of statistics, said that the existing evidence suggests that remote viewing delivers results that are well above chance, and that that is strong evidence for this being an actual psychic ability. Ray Hyman, the skeptic, said that the evidence that they reviewed should give advocates of remote viewing reasons for optimism, that the evidence looked better than it ever had before, and that it did seem to be beyond chance, but he personally was not convinced that it was an actual psychic ability, but that it warranted further study, and if the evidence kept coming in the way it had, he could change his mind about whether it's a real psychic ability. So this is the skeptic they brought in.
Right.
And so, so I will leave other people to decide which viewpoint they think. But subsequent to the closing of the program, it was declassified, and many of the people involved have been teaching courses in how to use this technique. And they report getting better than chance accuracy. If that is the case, then it would not simply be a waste of money. On the other hand, if you're trying to do this and it's giving you better than chance accuracy, well, you're getting something for your money. Whether it's enough to justify the money you're paying is another matter. There are also questions about how this fits with, you know, the Christian faith. I haven't addressed it from that perspective. If you want to know more about that, I would suggest checking out my podcast, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. In particular, episodes 102 and 103 on remote viewing, and 105 and 106 on St. Thomas Aquinas and the occult, where I show the principles he used to evaluate paranormal things. And then also my two of my most recent episodes with one of the former Stargate psychic spies, a guy named Paul Smith.
David, thank you very much for the question. I hope that that was helpful to you, and I'm glad to hear you're familiar with Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World and with weird questions that we do here, which has its own theme song, by the way.
Yeah, it does. Got a brand new theme song, new and improved.
We got to take a quick break, though, David, so I will leave it there. I want to let you know that my new book, A Teacher of Strange Things, Who Jesus Was, What He Taught, and Why People Still Follow Him, still has a promo code that you can save 25% off on if you get it at shop.catholic.com. Don't know how much longer that's going to be around, but it's been out there pretty much this whole month. So if you'd like to get that 25% off on A Teacher of Strange Things, use the promo code TEACHME when you check out at shop.catholic.com and get that 25% off.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Now there's a fast and easy way to get in touch with EWTN. The EWTN Everything Number. Call 1-800-447-EWTN to get the latest information on programming, special events, pilgrimages, and more. Our EWTN Family Viewer Services representatives are ready to help you with whatever your needs may be. The EWTN Everything Number. 1-800-447-EWTN. EWTN.
A lot of people think that street evangelization involves yelling out of a bullhorn telling people that they're going to hell. Not so with St. Paul's Street Evangelization. Our methods are non-confrontational and effective. We simply offer information on the Catholic faith, along with rosaries, miraculous medals, and prayer. Pope Francis wrote about how beautiful it is to see street preachers joyfully bringing Jesus to every corner of the earth. Street evangelization is fun and fruitful. Join us today at streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Thanks for being with us. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin's here, and lots of folks on the line with questions. It's open forum, and so we will go right back to the lines. We're going to Shreveport, Louisiana. Louis in Shreveport, Louisiana, you are next. Go ahead with your question, Louis.
Yes, so we have a daughter that's getting married, marrying a non-Catholic, so there's questions as to whether the Mass would be sacramental. And if then the second question, part of that is, if he, being a Baptist, does not want to do a sacramental Mass, but he's willing to do a Catholic blessing, is there such a thing as a Catholic blessing? And then the third part of the question is, whether it's a sacramental Mass or a blessing, if that's allowed, does it have to be does it have to be at the Catholic Church as a sanctified place?
So, well, all Masses are sacramental because the Eucharist is a sacrament and it takes place in the context of a Mass. Not all weddings take place in a Mass, though. So if there's a Mass, well, the Mass is definitely sacramental. The relevant question here is, will their marriage be valid or not? Now, since he's Baptist, he's already a baptized Christian, and your daughter as a Catholic is also a baptized Christian. So anytime two baptized Christians get married, whether they're Catholic or not, if it's a valid marriage, it is automatically a sacramental marriage. So what options are there in this case? Well, your daughter, being a Catholic, is a citizen of the Catholic Church, and so she needs to obey the Church's marriage laws, just like as a citizen of Louisiana, she needs to obey the marriage laws of the state that she's a citizen of. And in this case, she needs to do one of two things. Either she needs to observe the Catholic form of marriage, which is typically done during a Mass, though it isn't always. Or she needs to get a dispensation from her bishop to have a non-Catholic marriage, such as in her fiancé's Baptist church. And both of those are possibilities. What she would need to do is talk to the pastor of her parish and say, hey, I'm looking at getting married. Please help me, with the necessary process. There are going to be some marriage preparation. You know, they may They typically have a program at local parishes to help prepare people who are planning on getting married to make sure they understand what marriage is and what it's going to be like, and talk about questions they need to talk about, like how many, you know, are we planning on kids, or what's the deal here? So there are various issues that need to be worked through prior to getting married, and parishes have and dioceses have programs to help people with that. They're sometimes called pre-cana. They're basically marriage preparation programs. And as to whether to have a Catholic ceremony in the Catholic Church or get a dispensation to have a ceremony in the fiancé's church, both of those are options that can be worked through as part of that process.
Thank you very, very much for the question. I hope that that was helpful to you. Let's go now to Cincinnati, Ohio. Dave in Cincinnati, Ohio, listening on Sacred Heart Radio, 740 AM. You're next, Dave. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thanks for your scholarship. My question is, I've heard rumors of there's two different popes, mm-hmm. and the second pope is called a black pope. And obviously, I don't know if it's true or not, but I don't believe it is. But if it isn't, what's the story? Do you have any info?
Well, there are various strands of two-popism, if you want to call it that. The standard, or historically, the most common is that, okay, there's the Pope in Rome, and then there's someone else who claims to be the Pope. Frequently, it's someone who is mentally ill and is just a lone guy living above his mother's pizza shop in an apartment and, you know, calls himself Pope Michael or something like that in Kansas.
That sounds oddly specific, Jimmy. Is this something that actually has happened?
There is a Pope Michael. I can't say that he's mentally ill, but typically, historically, there's always crazy people who think they're something they're not.
Right.
You know, whether it's Jesus or Napoleon or the Pope.
Or Michael Jackson.
Or I suppose Michael Jackson, yeah. And so there's always a few of these in any given age, in any given period of history. There's always a few lone people who have no real claim to be the Pope, but nevertheless assert that they are. And so that's kind of the more historically common version. Now, in the last few years, there has been another form of two-popism arise, in which after Pope Benedict resigned the papacy and Pope Francis was elected, some people didn't like Pope Francis and said, ooh, maybe he's not really the Pope. Maybe we can argue somehow that Pope Benedict still is. Well, except for the fact that former Pope Benedict has been really clear on multiple occasions that no, he is not the Pope anymore. He did genuinely resign, and Pope Francis is the only Pope. Then there is based on a remark you made, Dave, I think what you may have encountered, which is misunderstanding. There is a person who is sometimes referred to as the Black Pope. He's not actually the Pope. This is a kind of nickname. What he actually is the head of the Jesuit order.
Oh.
And he's called the Black in Black Pope is because Jesuits wear black to distinguish him from the actual Pope who for the last number of centuries has worn white. But he is this high-ranking guy who hangs out in Rome because he's head of a worldwide order. And so since he's this high-ranking guy hanging out in Rome, he gets called the quote-unquote Pope, even though everybody knows he's not. And so he's called the Black Pope, and all it means is he's the head of the Jesuit order.
What do you think, Dave?
Well, I've seen pictures of that guy.
Uh-huh.
And I always thought it was connected to the Freemasons.
Has nothing to do with that. The Black Pope is simply the head of the Jesuit order.
It's funny. I thought it was going to say Coptic Christians because isn't the head of
head of the Coptic Church is also called the Pope, and he is. I mean, the word Pope just means father, and so it's a title that gets used for more than one religious official. Originally, it was used for bishops in general.
Oh, they were all called Pope?
Yeah, Popes are different. Look, yeah, and but then it in English and in various European languages, it became more restricted. So today it applies to the Catholic Pope in Rome and to the Coptic Pope in Alexandria.
Oh, yeah. I had never heard of the Jesuit thing, though. It's like that seems like a kind of an insider Catholic nickname.
Yeah,
type of
exactly.
Thing. Yeah. Okay. Thanks very much, Dave. Hope that was helpful to you. We're going to go to New Orleans, Louisiana now, listening on the almighty 690 AM. Peter in New Orleans, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, I feel like I'm letting you guys down. Everybody on this program has been named David so far, but my middle name is David, so.
Okay, that's probably why you were let through. All right.
Yeah. So I met this guy at work recently. He's a really nice guy. He's one of the only people at work that I see eye to eye with about mm-hmm. a lot of things, and he's Christian, but he's Pentecostal.
Uh-huh.
So I was, because I care about this guy, and I wanted to, and he was inviting me to church mm-hmm. as well, and so I started looking into the religion a little bit, right? I started looking into the Pentecostal church, and I was noticing a lot of similarities in because they have these beliefs in, like, these charisms. They kind of believe that they can, like, speak in tongues or things like that, and it reminded me a lot of this group that my little sister goes to, which is a Catholic charismatic group,
mm-hmm.
and I know for a fact that a lot of people in that group treat it with a lot of superstition. And it made me question, is the charismatic movement even a valid thing to begin with, or is it just born from, like, is it an offshoot of this Protestant Pentecostal church?
Well, so there is a historical connection between the Catholic charismatic movement and the Protestant Pentecostal movement. The Protestant Pentecostal movement really got rolling in the early 1900s. There was kind of an initial burst in 1900 itself, and then it really got started in Los Angeles in 1906 at what's known as the Azusa Street Revival. Cy Kellett, host of Catholic Answers Live, on what street would you anticipate that the Azusa Street Revival took place?
I can do this one.
Mm-hmm.
I think Azusa Street.
Yeah, very good. I wanted to give you a shot at redemption.
I needed that. Thank you, Jimmy.
any guess where Azusa comes from, the name?
Oh, I know this because uh-huh. I've actually heard you say it before.
Okay.
A to Z USA.
That's right. It comes from A to Z USA. So the Pentecostal movement then grew from the Azusa Street Revival and became very prominent a movement in Protestant Christianity, not only here in the United States, but in other countries too. In the 1960s, and as they did that, they founded their own denominations, like the Assemblies of God, for example, is a classic Pentecostal denomination that got formed in the early 20th century. And there were others too. But by the 1960s, you started having members of other Protestant denominations becoming interested in maybe there's something to these spiritual gifts that they're talking about. Maybe we should be practicing them in our churches too, but we then don't need to quit our churches and join another denomination. Yeah. And so that became the charismatic movement, where you started to have charismatic Baptists and charismatic Methodists and charismatic Lutherans and so forth, and charismatic Catholics. Because the New Testament does talk about these spiritual gifts like healing and tongues and prophecy and so forth, and it never says they're going to stop. This is actually one of the points that Pentecostals and Protestant charismatics made, and they're absolutely right about. It never says these miraculous gifts are going to stop. So there's a question in every age of how often does God give them, and if we ask for them, how likely is God to give them to us? And so when the church's hierarchy looked at that question, they said, well, there's no reason that these gifts can't be used among Catholics. In fact, historically, down through church history, there have been reports of miraculous gifts like this. So we don't need to be afraid of them. And if God chooses to give them, we don't want to hamper the action of the Spirit in our own generation by saying, oh, you must not use these things. That would be quenching the Spirit, which Paul says in 1 Thessalonians 5 not to do, specifically in reference to the gift of prophecy. He says, don't quench the spirit by despising prophecies. He says, instead, take an open, critical attitude towards them. Test everything he says and hold fast to what is good. And so that's the essential attitude that the Catholic Church has taken towards these miraculous gifts. They shouldn't be uncritically accepted, so they should be tested, but they shouldn't be despised, and we can hold fast to what is good. In particular cases, in different circles, people may be under critical, they may be superstitious.
Right.
But in principle, there's nothing wrong here. It's a matter of proper critical discernment.
Peter, thank you. Sorry, Danny and Diane, we didn't get to your questions, but we're doing open forum again tomorrow. So if you'd give us a call back, maybe we can remember that. Danny and Diane, will put them to the top if they call in first hour tomorrow. Jimmy, you going to be with us tomorrow?
Yeah, I am.
All right, we'll see you then for another open forum on Catholic Answers Live. Maybe a little bit of grooviness happening as well. We'll see. Darren's running the board. We'll see. In any case, we'll see you then, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.